This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Well, you know, in recent months, as a number of you are no doubt aware, there's been a spate of books published examining the fates and current struggles of America's working class. Now I'd recommend that you add to the top of your must-read list on this subject, Janesville, An American Story, by Amy Goldstein. Amy is a longtime Washington Post reporter who's taken a deep dive into the community of Janesville, Wisconsin, describing in gripping and revealing detail what happens when economic disaster strikes a community. In the case of Janesville, it was the closing in late 2008 of what had been the oldest operating General Motors plant in the country, a factory that had started turning out tractors in 1919 and then Chevrolets in 1923. Union workers there were earning $28 an hour with some very good benefits. Then all that stopped, and Amy recounts the many ripple effects that ensued, effects on other businesses, on family lives, and on relationships. While focusing on a single community, Amy was able to explore the larger realities of how Americans are trying to cope with job losses and financial hardships. She examines the shortfalls of retraining programs, the limitations of social services, and the political divisions and partisan rancor that can pull apart even the most established communities. These damaging effects aren't always simple to trace or explain, but the power and disturbing impact of Amy's book comes in its refusal to be satisfied with simplifications. As a glowing New York Times review of the book said, Amy, quote, opts for complexity over facile explanations and easy polemics. This isn't surprising for anyone who's followed Amy's reporting over the years. She's as thorough and smart a journalist as they come. My wife, who was the Maryland editor at the Washington Post in the mid-1980s, was the one who hired Amy 30 years ago and remembers interviewing her for the job. She says Amy asked lots of questions, so many, in fact, that it wasn't clear who was interviewing whom. Amy went on to spend her first decade at the paper covering local education and regional health care. She then moved to the national staff to write about health policy. During the first term of George W. Bush, she covered the White House, focusing on domestic issues. She was part of the team of Post reporters that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for coverage of the 9/11 attacks and the government's response to them. In more recent years, she has written extensively about social policy, and in recent days, she's been covering the healthcare debate or debacle or whatever you want to call it. So while she'd much rather talk about Janesville tonight, she understands this is Washington, and she's very willing to take some questions on what's been happening in the last few hours on the Hill and where we go from here with healthcare. And with that, please join me in welcoming Amy Goldstein.
Well, thank you, Brad, for that really generous introduction. You know, I just returned yesterday from nearly a week on the road talking about this book, mostly in Wisconsin. And on Saturday afternoon, I was at the Janesville Public Library, where it was this very sentimental event for me, because most of the people in the story came to hear me talk about their own story. And during the question and answer period, somebody asked me a question and said, well, after you spent all this time in Janesville, would you ever move here? And I had to quickly and deftly come up with an answer. So I said, well, Janesville will always be part of my life. But, you know, thinking about it, my life is in Washington. So this is really a nice homecoming with so many people in this room from all these different corners of my life here, come out to see, and other people who are interested in hearing about this work I've been doing for several years. And it's particularly a wonderful homecoming to be with Brad and implicitly with Lissa, who, as Brad, you said, Lissa called me, she cold called me while I was sitting at my desk at the Baltimore Sun one late summer day in 1987 and said, would I consider applying for an education writing job at the Post? So Lissa is really why Washington is my home, so especially nice to be here. So that's how I got to Washington. As for how I got to Janesville, I first stepped into Janesville on July 26, 2011, and I was on an exploratory mission trying to get a feel for what had been going on in town. I had lined up a few people to meet. And the first guy I saw was somebody named Stan Milam, who was an old-time journalist in town. Stan had been the State House bureau chief for the Janesville Gazette, the local newspaper, but he'd already left the paper by the time I met him, and he had a radio show and was working as an education consultant with an office in what had in the first half of the 20th century been the world headquarters of the Parker Pen Company, which also comes from Janesville, and was now renovated into offices, many of which were empty. And Stan was in his 60s, he grew up in Janesville, and we talked nonstop for a few hours about what the town used to be like and what it was like now, and we just talked and talked. And finally, Stan asked me the question I've been hoping that he would ask, which was, would you like to see the assembly plant? Of course I did. So I got into the car of this man I had just met, and we drove down Center Avenue in Janesville and turned left onto Delavan Drive, and there was this immense dead auto plant, all 4.8 million square feet of it. And as we were approaching the plant, Stan said something to me that surprised me. He said, he hates to go by this. Now, having just known him a few hours, I was surprised by that because I could already tell that Stan was a tough-minded reporter and, as he often says about himself, quite the cynic. He's not a softie. So I asked him, why did he hate to see the plant? And he said his father had worked there. And as a boy, Stan remembered his father's pride at having earned enough money that the GM wages had allowed him to buy his first Chevy. And that really struck me. I thought if this tough seasoned reporter cringed at the sight of a closed assembly plant, that said a lot about what had been going on in the small city, something about identity and about how life had been and about how people expected it to be, but it wasn't like that anymore. So why was I in Janesville that day on this exploratory mission? Well, I had begun thinking a couple of years before about writing a close-up of what really happens when work goes away. And Brad, as you mentioned, I was at the time covering a very eclectic social policy beat. And I've been long time been drawn to stories that lie at the intersection of politics and policy and help explain how both affect ordinary people. So the story of what happened after the Janesville Assembly Plant closed down is very much in that tradition. I just got a little carried away this time. So the more specific reason I was in Janesville is that when the Great Recession arrived near the end of 2007 and during the time of the recession and afterwards, I really was thinking about how the bad economic times was changing people's lives in this country. And I wrote a few stories for the Post that were about that theme. And I was watching other people's writing, which I noticed tended to fall in two camps. There were stories about the bad economy and about the government's economic policies, about the stimulus package and political fighting over whether or not the policies were doing any good, whether they were helping or not helping. So that was one set of stories. And then in the midterm election of 2008, there were all these stories about voter anger and voter anxiety. And I began to think that you really couldn't understand what this voter anxiety was about unless you looked at people's economic circumstances and fears, the jobs that they had lost, or their fears that maybe their jobs would be the next ones to disappear. And what struck me is I didn't see much writing that was fusing these two things. And I just thought that you couldn't really understand what was going on in this country unless you looked at people's personal economic experiences and their own trauma. During this time, I came across a Pew study that looked at 10,000 news stories about the Great Recession that were aired or written during the first half of 2009 as the recession was ending. And it found that most of those stories were about the government bailout and about banks and the auto industry. of these 10,000 stories, how many were about average Americans? 5%. Well, this struck me as a huge and important gap, that we all knew what the unemployment statistics were, but we didn't know what it was like to have work go away. So I became obsessed with the idea of trying to explain this. I became so obsessed that I did something I have never done in my career before, which was take a leave from my longtime job to try to pursue this work. And I had the idea that it would be interesting to focus on one community that had lost a lot of work as a microcosm or a metaphor for what was going on broadly. Well, if you think about it, if you're going to write about a place as a microcosm or a metaphor, you better choose carefully. So how, you might wonder, did I end up in Janesville? It was never a place that I had been to. I didn't know anyone there. I had not been there before. And I had heard about it when I was looking for a story that I did about recession effects for the Washington Post. And somebody mentioned to me that there was this town I had never heard of that had just lost a big old auto plant. And I didn't go there at the time because the plant closing was pretty fresh. And a lot of the people who'd worked at GM itself, as opposed to people who'd worked at some of the supplier companies or other people in town who were losing work, those people still had what was called subpay or extra union unemployment pay in addition to regular unemployment benefits. So the pain hadn't really begun to seep in yet, so I didn't go there at the time. But as I was thinking about doing this bigger project, it just lingered in my mind, and it did so for a few reasons. First, I needed a place that had lost a lot of jobs, and Janesville definitely qualified. There are different figures you can find, but if you look at the statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, about 9,000 jobs disappeared in 2008 from Rock County, which is the county in which Janesville is the county seat. The unemployment rate shot up from 5.4% in June of 2008, before these jobs began to go away, to over 13% by the next March. Definitely qualified in the job loss department. Beyond that, I thought it would be important to tell the story of what this Great Recession had done. So I wanted a place that had never been part of the Rust Belt before. So I wouldn't be writing, in effect, about sort of an accumulation of economic decay, but just about what this bad time had produced. And Janesville had been, as you said, Brad, producing cars and trucks since 1923. And over the decades, products had come and products had gone. There were these sine waves of things were better or worse, but something always came and replaced products that went away. So it had been a very stable economy. Another reason was that I knew that no place could be a substitute for every place in the country. But as much as possible, I thought it would be important to look at somewhere that mirrored the national pattern of job losses during this recession. Now, in this recession, the largest proportion of jobs that disappeared were in the manufacturing sector. That was true of Janesville. They were tended to be jobs that came with pretty good pay, but didn't require a lot of higher education. That was true of these auto jobs. There were more men than women who lost jobs in this recession. That was true of Janesville. So it seemed like, you know, if I was looking for a metaphor, it seemed like a pretty typical place. I also thought that, as I was just starting to read up on this place before I took this exploratory visit, that Janesville would fit nicely into the sweep of American history. I remember early on finding a YouTube video of Barack Obama, when he was a senator, giving a speech at the Janesville Assembly Plant, which he was laying out his economic position. And I just remember getting goosebumps when I heard him say on this YouTube video, "The promise of Janesville is the promise of America." Well, I heard that YouTube for the first time after all these jobs went away, so there was obviously this irony to what he was saying. But I liked that I could use those words in what I was planning to write. General Motors had been part of the famous GM sit-down strike in the 1930s. In the 1940s, it had been part of the domestic effort for World War II, when it stopped making cars and started turning out 16-millimeter artillery shells for the war effort. As I said, it was also the home of Parker Penn, which had been founded in 1888 and had its own big moments through the 20th century. So there was like the Zelig-like quality, I thought, that Janesville represented. Finally, Janesville had interesting politics. Before I knew anything about the place, I already knew that there had to be something interesting to be found in an old UAW town that was represented in Congress by Paul Ryan in a state that was governed by Scott Walker. So I figured I might find something there. And Janesville is just a great all-American sounding name. I just love the name, so I thought it'd be fun to be writing about Janesville. So that's why on the summer day in 2011, I made the exploratory visit in which I met Stan Milam, who hated to see the assembly plant, but took me to see it anyhow. And the idea I had was I wanted this book to be a series of close-ups. I wanted to have this kaleidoscopic quality in which I was letting people get to know different people in town from different vantage points, people who had lost work and people who were trying to help people who had lost work cope. So there are many people in the community who are in the story. There's a social studies teacher at one of the high schools who creates a hidden away room filled with donated used jeans and food and prom dresses and school supplies, because she could see that there were teenagers whose families had been middle class but weren't anymore, and she decided to try to help them. There's the guy who's running the Rock County Job Center, which was kind of ground zero for where people went when all this work vanished. There's the main banker in town. She co-founded an economic development coalition to try to bring jobs back to the area. There's a school social worker who was raising money to try to create housing for a new crop of homeless teens that was emerging in town, largely because families that had been working class or lower working class were falling out of the working class into poverty because the people who had good middle class jobs were taking the jobs that those folks used to have. And yes, there are politicians, including Paul Ryan, who let me interview him a few times before he became speaker. But the core of the story is about three families of dislocated workers. I was just going to tell you a little bit about these people. You know, I really had to try, I was not quick at figuring out who I wanted the main families to be, because I thought that I really needed to understand, as I came to think about it, what choices people made when there were no good choices left about what they were going to do after their work vanished. So I kind of figured that out and then tried to find good illustrations of the transitions that people went through. And I should say that these transitions did not come fast. The first thing I noticed when I arrived in town 2.5 years after the assembly plant had closed was that there was still disbelief. There was still denial. People were still saying to me, this plant is going to reopen. I mean, there was just no precedent for this plant to stay closed. So people thought it was just a matter of time before it opened back up, before it got another product, before it was bestowed something else to make by General Motors. And it didn't happen. So it took people a long time, in many cases, to figure out what they were going to do. The first family that I focus on, their name is Vaughn. They were a big union family in town. They were one of two families in town with three generations of men who had been in United Auto Workers Local 95's executive committee. And Marv Vaughn, who's the older generation, was in his 60s, and he retired after 40 years, just a few weeks before his son and daughter were going to be laid off. So he's at his retirement party with all this guilt, realizing that his kids are never going to get the pension that he's just started to draw. His son, Mike, had been the union shop steward for the biggest supplier to General Motors. It was a seat manufacturing plant called Lear, and it had made seats in just-in-time production for the assembly plant. So these seats were delivered to the assembly plant just 3 hours before they were installed into the GM SUV, because SUVs were where the plant was making at the time. So you can imagine when the assembly plant went down, there was no work for Lear. I mean, the assembly plant had been its only customer. So Mike was in his early 40s when his job disappeared. His wife had lost her job several months before in an earlier shift that had been laid off. And he tried and tried to find union work and couldn't. So he finally starts thinking about what had his union work prepared him to do, and realized that the local technical college, where lots of people were going back to school to try to retrain, had a new program in human resources management that he thought might suit him. Well, if you think about the last word in that, management, that was a pretty foreign concept to Mike Vaughn. And he really had to think about whether he could bridge this divide. And he finally came to think that if he could help people from the union side, he could probably help workers from the management side. But there's a scene in the story in which Mike has to break the news to his dad and is worried how his father's going to react. The second story, family in the story, are the Wopats. And they were also people who had been in town for a long time. And Matt Wopat kept hearing from his dad, who had also retired, that just wait, the plant's going to open up, the plant's going to open up. So he was kind of mildly looking for work, but not too worried about it. And the family finances really started falling apart. I mean, he had a wife who had a bad part-time job, and he was collecting, you know, GM union benefits that were going to go away pretty soon. So he went back to school, and he decided that he was going to retrain to go into work at the utility company. So he started studying electric power distribution, because the idea was that there were older guys working for the power company who were eligible to retire. So the word on the street was that there were jobs that were going to open up. So this is what Matt begins to study. And like a lot of people, I mean, it's pretty traumatized. I mean, just imagine that you're in your late 30s or 40s. You haven't been in school for half a lifetime. You have no income coming in. You didn't necessarily like school when you were younger, and you have to start studying. So Matt was studying after dinner with his, doing homework with his three daughters at the kitchen table, feeling a little silly, but he was doing it, and he was getting decent grades. And several weeks before he was going to graduate, he started really focusing on the fact that these utility jobs were not opening up. So he was worried at this point that they were going to lose their house if he didn't figure out something fast. So he began to do something that he had just sworn he was never going to do. So in the days when all this work existed, the GM jobs were kind of the fat cat jobs in town. They had better pay, they had better benefits. And even when the work went away, the GMers themselves had an advantage that the other people in town didn't, which is that they had transfer rights to work at other General Motors plants that were still going. So Matt became what's known as a GM gypsy. There are a lot of families in town that don't want to move, so the GM worker takes a job far away and commutes home as best that they can. So Matt started working in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about 300 miles away. And for 7 years now, he's been commuting to Fort Wayne with a bunch of other guys and carpools every Monday morning, coming home late on Friday nights. He's got 8 more years until he's eligible for the pension that his dad has. Third family are the Whitakers. And Jared Whitaker had been at GM just about as long as Matt Wopat. And he decided that he did not want to leave his family, and his family certainly didn't want to leave Janesville. So he takes a GM buyout, which is a pretty lousy buyout. It was a couple $1,000s. But it came with 6 extra months of health insurance for the family, which was incredibly important because Jared's been bouncing in and out of very bad paid jobs, many of which don't come with health benefits. So that's why he took the buyout. And that foreclosed the possibility that he could ever go to work for General Motors again, even if the economy improved or they wanted to move. So he wasn't working enough money, making enough money. His wife was working 2 bad part-time jobs and not making enough money. They have 3 kids. And when I met them, their daughters, who are twins, were in high school and were working 5 jobs between them. Really bright kids, AP students, taking all the honors courses, taking courses at the local college, working 5 jobs, and they began offering to help pay the family bills. So that's the third family, the Whitakers. So I wrote this book in very short chapters, kind of moving chronologically through time over 5 years, with each chapter from somebody else's perspective. But I also knew when I started out that I wanted this to be kind of a layered book. That even a book which has a fairly large number of characters, you can only write about so many people. And I thought about how to make sure that I was making clear that the experiences of these close-up people were representative of broader truths. So I hooked up with some academics and did 2 quantitative pieces of work that are kind of the scaffolding for all this story. And one piece of work was looking at job retraining. I basically looked at people in this part of southern Wisconsin who had and had not gone back to school, and what became of them a few years later. And very surprisingly, at least to me, it turned out that people who had not retrained were more likely to be working every part of the year and had less drop in pay from before the recession. The second piece of work that I did that was quantitative was a survey that I did with some people at the University of Wisconsin. It was a survey just of Rock County, and it was trying to just get at what were people's economic experiences and attitudes. We did this in 2013, so it was 5 years after the recession ended and about 4 years after the last of these auto industry jobs went away. And we asked questions like, do you think the recession's still going on or not in this country? 3/4 said yes. We also asked questions just of people who said that they or someone in their home had lost work. things like, are you losing sleep? 75% said yes. Are you avoiding social situations? 43% said yes. Are you having strain in family relationships? 75% said yes. And the thing that really got to me was the question that asked whether people were embarrassed or ashamed about having been out of work. More than half said yes. And that, in combination with all these interviews that I have been doing, told me something that I thought was really important to understand, which was that losing work is really personal. Even when you're losing work in a context in which your neighbors are losing work and the people you work next to are losing work, it's still really personal. So I'm going to read a little bit from one chapter. It's towards the end of the story, and it's about Matt coming home on a Friday night from Fort Wayne. It's called Night Drive. Come on, get the hell out of here, a guy shouts as he bursts out the door and speedwalks across the terracotta-tiled lobby, barely slowing to slide his ID card through the punch clock. Friday night at the Fort Wayne assembly plant, the end of the work week, the end of second shift, a 9-hour shift today with a lucky hour's overtime. So that's 11:45 p.m. as this guy is shouting, one guy among 1,100 GMers, pouring off the factory floor to start their weekends. Amid this horde, Matt Wopat reaches the lobby at 11:47 p.m. wearing a knit cap, a backpack slung over one shoulder. He is not running, but he too is walking very, very fast, a Friday night ritual. He reaches the chilly night air, and a coworker wishes him a safe drive tonight. He stops for an instant at the 97 Saturn, which he parks in the same part of the vast lot every Friday, in the middle row under the street lamp, so he won't have to think about where he's left his car when he returns on Monday. He pulls his duffel from the trunk and continues walking very, very fast over to a nearby 2003 Grand Prix already idling. In the driver's seat is Chris Aldrich, and the back seat, his coat scrunched up between him and the door, is Paul Sheridan, Janesville GM Gypsies both. Chris pops the trunk for Matt to toss the duffel inside and slam the trunk shut before he gets in the passenger side. Matt's door barely closed when Chris guns the engine and roars off. 280 miles to go. 4 hours and 30 minutes speeding just a little where they're pretty sure they will not get caught. Matt pulls out his phone, calls Darcy to tell her they are leaving, same as he does every week. When Chris guns the engine, it's 11:54 p.m. in Fort Wayne, except that Matt is not the only one who stays on Janesville time, so the dashboard clock on the Grand Prix says 10:54. Chris started working at Fort Wayne on August 17, 2009, 7 months before Matt. Chris will never forget that day, his wife and kids along to help him move, except that he doesn't like to say that he moved, so he says he stays in Fort Wayne. Anyhow, his family left on Monday morning when he went to the plant for orientation, which was during first shift, so that he was back in his new apartment by 3:30 that afternoon, and he sat on a chair from a cheap dinette set they'd just gotten, staring at a wall. His wife and kids already back in Janesville, one of the worst feelings of his life. That was 3.5 years ago. The Grand Prix had 47,000 miles on it. Now it has 134,407. On this night, they are not yet 10 minutes from the plant, about to turn onto Route 114, when Matt says in his quiet way, "This is my 3-year anniversary." Chris doesn't miss a beat. "We aren't going to celebrate that," he shoots back. Matt already texted Darcy before going to work, "Happy anniversary to me, 3 years." And the reply came back, "Has it been 3 years? Seems a lot longer." Darcy had added a sad-faced emoticon. 3 years, even with GM vacations factored in, is a lot of Fridays hurtling through the night to get home. This week, it snowed 10 inches in Fort Wayne, but then it thawed and today was sunny. Tonight is clear, so the stars are bright on the drive through the Indiana farmland, so much flatter than Wisconsin's. "Think we'll get lucky and get a double raccoon tonight?" Chris asks. Last summer, on the stretch of 114, with exquisite timing, one raccoon ran into the road from the right and another from the left, and the Grand Prix struck them both, one with a front tire and one with a rear. You don't get that every week. but they do get the house alongside the road, whose occupants have a flair for decorating. Tonight it's lit up like Christmas, but in green and gold, with shamrocks for St. Patrick's Day coming up. US 30 gives them a chance in the summer to try to guess what's playing at the drive-in movie theater just off the road. Not Chris, whoever's turn it is to drive, but the passengers craning their necks to get a quick peek at the screen at an angle. And one time they drove through a giant thunderstorm with lightning bolts that along this flat land of long views they could see shooting straight down into the fields. No matter the season, there's always the Bourbon Bible Church with its weird, larger-than-life David and Goliath diorama that you can see as you drive by. Matt's phone rings. It's Bria, his youngest, calling past her bedtime. In Indiana, he says, about 3 hours probably. Okay, sweetie, I'll let you go. Love you too. And now they are in Valparaiso, where they stop, as always, at the truck stop called the Pilot Travel Center. Some of the Janesville gypsies wait until the next fast food stop, the one just before the Illinois line. But Chris and Paul and Matt like this one for its good snacks and multiple bathrooms. Then it is north onto Highway 49 and west onto the toll road. You're going under the speed limit, says Paul, who's mostly been sleeping curled up against his coat. Fuck you, Chris says. You want the tire to wobble off? You know how to change a tire, Paul says. Matt jumps in. You're doing a good job, Chris. Thanks, Chris says. You are very supportive. And now they're whizzing by Gary with what remains of its steel mills on the right. Light sparkling, gray smoke plumes dissolving into the sky, a flicker of flames. Gary was known as Magic City when U.S. Steel arrived in 1906 to build the mills on Lake Michigan's southern shore. Now its population of 78,000 is less than half of what it was in its heyday of 1960. 4 of the 10 people left are living in poverty. Gary is a perfect specimen of what the Rust Belt looks like and what Janesville is striving not to become. Chris drives on. It is almost 1:30 a.m. Janesville time when the Grand Prix glides through a toll booth with an easy pass and enters Illinois, the Skyway, and then the Dan Ryan Expressway, which gets clogged even with its 14 lanes. The Dan Ryan is easy to cruise along tonight because with the extra hour at the plant, the overtime, they are later than usual, and most of the city of big shoulders, as Carl Sandburg christened it for the toil of piling job on job, is asleep. The downtown skyline comes into view. Just north of Chicago, a red car passes with 4 guys inside. Tom is driving, Chris notes. Almost looks like O'Leary in back. More Janesville gypsies. Matt dozes off for a few moments, joining Paul in his slumber. Chris doesn't like the silence. You are supposed to be doing color commentaries, he teases Matt when he wakes up. Good thing Matt is awake when, a little after 2 a.m., a text arrives on his phone. It's from yet another car filled with Janesville gypsies, up ahead. Mile marker 28 or so, cop in the median, Chris slows. 9 miles later, Matt spots the cop. No likely tickets, Chris says, can't afford to. The one time Matt got pulled over, the summer before last, he told the officer the truth, that he works in the Fort Wayne during the week and was driving home, and he guessed he was just a little bit excited to get there and see his family. The cop said he could understand and let Matt off. They passed the Belvedere Chrysler plant, the one that wasn't hiring when the assembly plant shut down. When they get to Rockford, Chris says, the home stretch. We'll have Paul in his driveway in 20 minutes. Holy shit, we're nearly home, Matt says. Paul continues his gentle snores. And at this hour, 2:41 a.m. Janesville time, Chris gets philosophical about spending his work weeks in Fort Wayne. Funny how we count time, he says. I count how many Christmases I have to spend there. 3 more Christmases. He's coming up on 27 years since he became a GMer on August 17, 1986, part of a big hiring wave that came right after Janesville survived one of its near-death experiences. When the last day really came, December 23, 2008, Chris was down at the plant shooting video with a digital camera. His anniversary date means that Chris has 3 years and 7 months until he can retire. Matt has 12 years and 7 months. When I retire, Chris says, I don't want to leave you guys there. I want everyone home. Maybe that'll be my business after I retire. I'll become a shuttle guy and bring you guys home. Paul wakes up as the Grand Prix pulls off the interstate at exit 177. "Cool your jets," Chris says to Paul. "I'll have you home in a heartbeat." It is just after 3 a.m., Janesville time, because this is Janesville, when Chris pulls into Paul's driveway. After dropping him off, Chris drives up Center Avenue, crossing the Rock River, near where the assembly plant still stands silent. Then up Centerway Street and up Milton Avenue to Matt's nice house on the north edge of town that he and Darcy have managed to keep because he is a gypsy. It's a straight shot up through town, but sometimes they go through town different ways, just because it's nice to be home, nice to see Janesville streets. At 3:20 a.m., Chris pulls into the driveway of the beige house with the dark red front door. Darcy hasn't remembered to turn on the outside light, but she's left the light on in the laundry room, just inside the garage door where she and the girls once cried as Matt was leaving for Fort Wayne the first time. Matt hands Chris a $20 bill for gas and oil changes when the Grand Prix needs them. "What time are you going to be here Monday morning?" Matt asks just before pulling his duffel out of the trunk. "Probably 8:10, 8:15, Chris says. "The usual." Thanks very much.
It sounds wonderful.
Thank you.
You haven't mentioned politics.
That's true.
Do you think these were Trump voters?
Were they
Sanders voters before that?
Okay, so you can imagine the morning after the election, I woke up and dashed to my computer to see what the vote in Rock County had been.
Sure.
And it was interesting because in 2012, when I was there on election day, mm-hmm. 2012, this is a Democratic place, right? It's an old UAW town that's kept that identity even after all these union jobs have gone away. So in 2012, 62% of Rock County's voters supported the re-election of Barack Obama. This fall, 52% voted for Hillary Clinton. So it was just barely Democratic. But it wasn't that there were more Republican votes. It was the Democratic turnout was way down.
And why do they vote for Paul Ryan?
Well, Paul Ryan's district is one of those gerrymandered places where the heart of his vote is really in a part of the state that kind of reaches north and a little bit east to a very Republican area.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
I'm very much looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
But in anticipation of your arrival, I already read ahead a little bit.
Okay, that's fair.
So, and I was particularly focused on Speaker Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the book, you talk about a meeting with the Forward Janesville crew and Bob Borman.
Yes.
Bob Borman, who runs the Rock County Job Center, had numerous times attempted to have Speaker Ryan come and see the work that they were doing at the Job Center. And as of, I guess it was 2013, Speaker Ryan had thus far not gone to the Job Center to see the work that it was doing with his constituents. Has he ever?
To my knowledge, he has not.
Did you ever ask him why not?
So Paul Ryan is, I'm going to broaden the question. Paul Ryan is a son of Janesville. I mean, he absolutely understood. I mean, the story begins with Paul Ryan standing in his kitchen, getting a call on his cell phone from the then chairman, the CEO of General Motors, giving him a heads up that the next morning there's going to be a public announcement that this plant was going to close. And Ryan immediately starts thinking about all these people he knows who are about to lose their work. So, I mean, he gets this. This is visceral for him. I mean, he went to high school with kids who were at the plant until the plant went away. He also obviously has his own set of ideological views, and he doesn't believe in earmarks. He did vote for the auto bailout, which was something that few conservative Republicans did. So, you know, I don't set out to, you know, praise or damn any of the political figures in the storm. That's not my role. I just wanted to show how different people saw it, and Paul sees it from his own vantage point.
Thank you.
Thank you for your book, and thank you for this presentation. You say Washington has been your home. I've always been very curious, and maybe it's not fair to ask you this. Background, you were clearly ahead of a lot of the media. You were clearly ahead of a lot of the people making decisions in the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party. I've always wondered, but the data have been there for longer than when you. I've often wondered why all these people at the top, supposedly really smart and informed and curious, could not understand the human dimension of what was happening and could be read in these numbers. And maybe you can explain that to me, because I've never been able to get it through my head.
Well, I'm going to answer that question in the context of the look I took at job training. Because if you think about the economic policies that Republicans and Democrats espouse, there's not a lot of intersection on those lists. But job training, job retraining is something that both political parties very much support. There also isn't much data on this. States have been very reluctant to give up the kind of you know, raw data that you need to do research into the efficacy of these job training programs. So, I mean, there was a national study sponsored by the government that was supposed to have been a 50-state study using data from just before the recession. 12 states were willing to release their data, so it wasn't really a national study. So, you know, I tend to think that it's kind of easier to think about, well, let's send people back to school than it is to figure out how are we going to recreate jobs.
That was my question. Do you have any theories about why the job retraining programs don't work?
Yeah,
didn't work?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? So the data that we generated, I'm saying we because I work with a couple of labor economists on this, don't provide the answer. But obviously, I talked to a lot of people and I thought about, you know, what could be explaining this. And I think it may be some mixture of a couple things. I mean, it's possible that those people who could get jobs got jobs and other people waited and went back to school because they couldn't find a job. It's possible that those jobs that were around, people took while other people were back in school for a year or two. I think a big factor is that even though, you know, this Wisconsin has a system of technical colleges that do just kind of the vocational training part of what community colleges do. And this little college, which was just inundated with laid off factory workers for a few years, tried, you know, I didn't know this when I began to talk to people there, but I really became very persuaded that they tried to do everything that a college could possibly do to be helpful. I mean, one of the things that the instructors quickly found was that a lot of these people who were coming to them didn't know how to use computers very well, so they started computer boot camps. They started study skills programs. They really worked with those businesses that were left in town to try to predict where jobs might lie a year or two hence and steer people into those programs. But I think there was just no getting around the fact that there weren't enough jobs.
Thanks.
For the workers who were laid off in Zanesville, were they given an option to relocate to other GM plants across the country? And if they were, was there like a percent who took advantage of this relocation?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So as I said, the people who had worked for GM itself, as opposed to all the other people who lost, you know, related work in town, did have these transfer rights, particularly if they have pretty good seniority, okay. Which a lot, I mean, this was a plant where people had very high seniority. So, I mean, I've seen different numbers. I never was able to get kind of solid numbers out of either the union or General Motors, but the local newspaper had some numbers at one point. There are various numbers. My impression was that there were more people who were doing this commuting thing, like Matt Wopat, because people are very anchored in Janesville. I mean, if you think about the same kind of work that's existed for generations, and when the plant was hiring, you got into the plant because you were handed an opportunity from somebody who worked in the plant. That's how it worked. So this was a familial thing, you know, one generation to the next. So there were extended families in town. People just didn't want to leave. Now, I know some families that tried the commuting thing and eventually did move the whole family. I mean, I know a school teacher whose husband was working in Kansas City, and they had young kids, and it was just too hard, and they finally all moved. I know somebody else whose husband was working for a couple years in Lansing, and they had young kids. And the wife was really involved in the community, and it really was hard for her, but they eventually uprooted and moved to Lansing, Michigan. So it's not that nobody moved, but a lot of people didn't want to do that. And the commuting was particularly prevalent among people who, unlike Matt, had just a few years until they were eligible for retirement. So they figured they would endure this for a while, and then they would live on these good pensions for the rest of their lives.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I've read the book, and it's beautifully written, and it's an important story. I've got 100 questions. I'll ask two, and if that's one too many, pick whichever one you want. One is, having done the research that you've done and found that the common wisdom of retraining isn't the answer, from your experience, are there things the community could have done, should have done differently, or is it just a matter of circumstances that when there aren't jobs, there aren't jobs? The other question is completely different, which is about the writing. 55 relatively short chapters. It was very interesting how you structured it, and I'm just curious as to if you knew that going in, or if that organically evolved as you were doing the research, and how you came to write it that way.
Well, let me give you a quick answer to the first question, then talk about the writing. Janesville's a pretty resilient place. In the story, I call it this kind of can-do place. And, you know, that sounds corny, but I think it's really true. I mean, it had this very long, proud industrial tradition going back more than a century. And it was kind of the antithesis of a place that, when all this job loss happened, just kind of laid down and took it. I mean, there are to this day pretty assertive efforts by local coalitions that have formed to try to bring work back to town. And they've had not perfect success, but they've had a little better success than places that don't try to do that. So I think it's just hard. And, you know, one of the things I came to think is that, you know, this is a place that really has been trying most of the things that a community can try. So it's in better shape. And, you know, if you ask people around town these days, how are things going with the economy, people invariably say, oh, it's coming back. So I think there may be something about that kind of affirmative mentality that's helpful. But the pay isn't anything like it used to be in town. So that's kind of the economic situation. In terms of the writing, so I didn't know how many chapters there were going to be. Mm-hmm. But I did know that I wanted to tell this story through rotating vantage points. So when I was working on a book proposal, which was itself kind of a long process, I just mapped out what was the best material I had for each person and tried to fit it together like a jigsaw puzzle. And that's how the story ended up working. Thank you.
As a Janesville native.
I love that. Thank you for coming.
Oh, my goodness. I wouldn't miss it. My siblings were from coast to coast and in between. My mother was at your book talk last week in Janesville with
that's
family
great.
Friends. And I would like to add a compliment. I think you wrote exquisitely about a place and a people I love. Maybe not everyone has this reaction, but my siblings and I, we found that independently you brought us to tears with some of the writing. Yeah. And I just wanted to pass that along because you really nailed it.
You're
writing, my mother is the next door neighbor of people that you write about in the book. So it's really beautiful. And I would add, in terms of the Janesville gypsies, we had family friends who traveled, who were gypsies, to Arlington, Texas.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Fort Wayne was the closest place you could go.
No, but Arlington, Texas,
yeah.
And the car full of people back and forth, and some families survived intact and some did not.
Absolutely. There were divorces over this, yeah.
I'm familiar with that, intimately
yeah.
familiar. But I'm wondering, and you maybe have answered it a little bit, going forward from May 2017, what do you think are some of Janesville's greatest strengths and greatest challenges? And thank you.
I hate predicting. So I think that this resilience is really important. Mm-hmm. You know, there are little bits of work and little bits of work coming into town. And they're still trying. So I think that's quite a strength. I also think that there's something kind of complicated about boosterism as a economic development mm-hmm. strategy. And that's what you hear among a lot of the business community. And I think that that boosterism has created kind of a cleavage in the community that didn't used to exist, because some people are saying things are better than ever. And some people are saying my life isn't so good. So I think that maybe you could say that's a way that this turned out to be a pretty metaphorical story for what's going on broadly in this country.
One of my favorite books is David Halberstam's The Renegade, which talks a lot about how industries first began to pinch on an American culture and life. Do you go back that far in your analysis, and do you find that book still valuable?
Well, you know, I had this very Janesville-centric view of life for several years while I was doing this, and obviously I did a lot of other reading. You know, I thought it was important for this work to really dig into Janesville's industry. So there's some historical stuff about these kind of two iconic local industrialists who created the economy of this town, because I really wanted to understand where this identity came from, where this set of expectations that life was going to be in the future the way it was in the past. So I did a lot of digging into the, you know, history archives locally to try to create a sense of what the past had been that gave rise to these expectations. Yes.
Hi, thank you so much for speaking tonight. I was wondering, you know, after this past election, a lot of people feel like the Democratic Party is really out of touch with labor in the United States. And I know that the Democratic Party is not, you know, a traditional labor party like, you know, what we see in the UK, for example. Did you feel like that was an idea that really resonated in, you know, the community there? You know, did you have any insights there, or I don't know, was this something that came to mind when you were writing the book?
Yeah, so I was really interested. I mean, I had not started out ever having covered anything about auto workers or the UAW, but I learned a lot through the lens of this one community. And let me just say a couple things about that. First, there was this really deep tradition in which the UAW was a political force. I mean, they used to, before elections, send out, you know, boots on the ground to get, you know, to get out the vote. And that's lingered to some extent after all these jobs went away. But the Union Hall, which is named after Walter Reuther, you know, the great hero, is really starved for money these days, and they're trying to rent itself out to have enough money to keep the lights on. And let me just sort of give you a microcosm of a microcosm answer. So Janesville has had this annual Labor Fest parade on Labor Day that was run by a combination of unions and businesses in town. The UAW was a huge force in it. So the first Labor Fest that I saw was in 2012. And it comes along Milwaukee Street and turns right on Main Street. It's this like beautiful little small town, I mean, not, you know, kind of small city parade. And I kept waiting for the UAW unit to march by. And there wasn't one. The only thing I saw were these two guys who said, UAW retirees, holding this little banner. And that was it. Mm-hmm. I found that pretty powerful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey. I've just gotten back from Janesville, obviously, from your victory tour. Well-deserved. Can you talk a little bit about the reactions from the families, the main families? I mean, they go through some difficult things. You have to get into difficult issues. And what their reaction has been, and if there's anyone you haven't heard from that you're waiting to hear from.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So you can imagine I was a little nervous about how people would feel once they read my take on their lives. You know, it's kind of a, you know, I talked to the main people in the story before the book came out and kind of said to them, you know, there's nothing that I know that I don't know because you told me. But it might look different coming from my perception of you than it feels to you, and you just should be prepared for that. I have not heard from a couple of the business people in the story who I was worried might yell at me because I don't, you know, I don't say things are terrible, but I don't buy into their everything's better than ever, vocabulary. I've heard from a lot of the families, and this is going to sound schmaltzy, I'm going to try not to weep about this, but people have said very flattering things, which is just great because, you know, doing this kind of work required people to really trust me, and they didn't know me when this began. And I didn't start asking them the most intimate questions, but, you know, I'd get to know them, I'd visit them, I'd call them up and say, you know, I need to ask you a couple more things. And that went on for years. And as I said, I was at the public library in Janesville on Saturday afternoon on this really, it was like 45 degrees and pouring, and a lot of people turned out. And Tammy Whitaker, one of the women in the book, when I was signing books afterwards, asked whether she could sit next to me. And I love that.
Well, I'm also from Janesville as well, born and raised there too. So I wonder if there's anyone else here. But not to get too political, but I was wondering if you could talk about the perception of Paul Ryan from the Janesville lens, because I think there is that dichotomy of, you know, being traditionally Democrat, but then having him fairly conservative.
Yeah. So when Ryan was, and I, you know, I made a decision to call Paul Ryan Paul in the book. You know, I call Scott Walker Walker because he's from outside town, but I figure Paul Ryan is part of the town, so he's just like Paul in the story. So when I talk about him, I'm not quite sure what to call him. But anyhow, I'm going to say Paul Ryan. When he was debating whether or not he was going to become a speaker, in this weird sort of job meets book confluence, I went out to Janesville to write a few stories for the Post about that question, about his relationship with his hometown. And just talked to a lot of people about whether they thought he was going to become a speaker, what they think about him. And what you generally find is that people, you know, sort of there's this Wisconsin niceness culture I'm sure you're familiar with. And Paul Ryan definitely is perceived to meet the niceness standard. I mean, people think he's a good guy, he's a hardworking guy. They really don't agree with his politics. And I mean, that's not, I mean, Janesville's no more monolithic than any other places, but that's a pretty widespread view that they think he's decent, but they don't agree with him.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's been really very interesting. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. One is, what has happened to the population overall of the town over the time? Yeah. And the second one is, what about the women?
Yeah, so the population, you would think would be going down. The population is a couple hundred larger than it was when I arrived in 2011. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've kind of wondered, why is this? I think it's partly this attachment. I don't else know what's going on. I mean, it's not like there's a big influx of jobs that are a magnet, but the population just has not been shrinking. The number of jobs in the county is actually close to back to what it was before the recession, though the pay is way down. So it's not like people aren't working or can't work, it's just that wages aren't so good. In terms of women, you know, I looked a lot at in the job retraining data at whether there were gender differences. There weren't. I mean, it was surprising because, you know, I had thought maybe more women than men would be comfortable going back to school. It was pretty, you know, there was no distinction. I looked to see what the graduation rates were like, whether men or women were doing better. It sort of surprised me that there was nothing interesting to say about the men versus women thing about this retraining. Historically, as I said, there were these two big anchors of the economy. There was Parker Pan and there was General Motors. And historically, I mean, historically meaning like from the early 20th century up through, you know, early 2000s, the boys coming out of high school went into General Motors if they were lucky, if they, you know, didn't want to go to college. And the girls went to Parker Pen. Because Parker Pen required a certain dexterity to be making fine writing implements. So there were sort of different notions depending on when you were graduating boy or graduating girl about what was a good thing to have happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I also want to thank you for a very interesting talk. I must say that I'm from the Caribbean, and in my part of the world, this is not a new story, right? Boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust. Okay. But two questions. The first question would be, this is a kind of difficult question because I do not know even if you have thought about this. You know, there's a lot of book coming out about this deindustrialization of the United States of North America, right? Same thing happening in Europe where I grew up. I grew up in the Netherlands. And Claire, research has shown that this thing is not something new. It starting out basically in the 50s, late 50s, beginning 60s, this process was all going. Obviously, after Soviet Union, you know, collapses, then it picks up. But yet, I'm asking this from a political, philosophical, political, theoretical point of view. In a democracy, if you really want a democracy to function to a large extent, you need to have a very much organized working class. It's the working class that is often the most democratic class, the class that pushes through the spreading, the deepening of rights and stuff like that, redistribution of rights, right? I think you might understand where I'm going with this, right? If you want, as a wealthy person, to create chaos, deindustrialization is not a bad idea, right? Because you touched on it already. In Janesville, the trade union is in big problems because, you know, the carrying capacity of it disappeared. Did you, in any of your readings, talks with people, have you ever heard that among the people, I'm not, because it could be conspirational that that this becomes, right? That, oh, they got together and stuff like that. No. These guys started to outsource, and then in outsourcing, they saw, well, Jesus, I can make much more money than you, so my factory goes too, right? If we were in this situation, we'd do the same thing. Let's just be honest. It politically would be difficult for me, but, you know. So the issue is there any proof anywhere? Has there been any research done? Because I find this question to be extraordinarily lacking in what I've read. To see that that when it became apparent to them, the benefits, the political benefits for this deindustrialization, that this process sped up. So that's the first question.
Let me just stop there. So I'm going to dodge your question, okay? Because this was not a work of political theory. It was sort of the antithesis of that. I mean, I was trying to really show what happens on the ground to a community and to people when the best of its work vanishes.
Right.
I didn't write this trying to steer policy in any direction. I wrote this to maybe stoke a little bit of empathy and to have people think about what the implications of what I was showing are.
And the second question would be that, was there any attempt during the closing of the factory, right, through tax breaks or other type of breaks, to keep the factory there? Because there's been a lot of attempts on that, and that doesn't work either. So thank you.
There was a huge effort to keep the factory open. And I'm glad you asked that question, because, you know, when I talked about this, was not a community that just sort of lay down and took this. When the plant was closing, the state of Wisconsin and Janesville as a city and Rock County as a county and the next city to the south, Beloit, Wisconsin, put together a record package of economic incentives to try to persuade General Motors to give this plant a new product to make. GM at the time was itself about to go bankrupt. It did go bankrupt as this decision was getting made, but General Motors was starting to produce, going to start producing a subcompact car. It was going to be the first subcompact made domestically in a long time by any U.S. automaker. And GM just assumed that it was going to get it because Janesville assumed it was going to get it because that plant had within General Motors a great reputation for quality. And Wisconsin put together what was a record offer of economic incentives, more than it ever offered, to try to get any business to come into town. It failed at that. It turned out that these were secret bids. There was a lot of bidding among different states to get this little car to manufacture. Turned out that Michigan offered many times more money. I mean, Michigan offered a huge amount. It had the highest unemployment in the country and was desperate to get these jobs, and Janesville did not get them. So yes, there was a very, very aggressive effort to try to reopen the plant, and it failed.
Any chance those jobs are coming back from GM?
You know, that's a good question. So when I talked about the disbelief and denial that persisted in town for years, I think that denial was helped along by the fact that General Motors, when it stopped production at the Janesville Assembly Plant, did not formally close the plant. It put it on a status called standby, which is kind of a limbo status in which nothing was happening at the plant, but it was eligible to be reopened if, you know, certain levels of demand for autos, rose up. That limbo status lasted for years. The local UAW local tried really hard and succeeded at persuading the international UAW to negotiate during the contract negotiations with General Motors to keep that plant on standby. And at first it was one of two GM plants that was on standby, and then for several years it was the only one in the whole GM firmament that was in this limbo status. But a year and a half ago, which was the most recent UAW GM contract negotiation, that status went away. So in the fall of 2015, the plant was formally closed. So no, those jobs are not coming back.
One more question?
Yeah.
So healthcare.
Ah.
We can't.
That.
I'm very curious about what from the perspective of folks in this town, you've already mentioned that some are very concerned about their health insurance. How do they view the machinations, the stuff that's going on in terms of the Affordable Care Act, and did it benefit them, you know, prior to this? And anyway, you see where I'm going with this.
So speaking of confluences between my book and my day job, so I don't focus so much on the Affordable Care Act because the ACA marketplaces started in, providing insurance in 2014, and the chronology, I mean, there's an epilogue, which is sort of where are things now, but the chronology ends partway through 2013. But, you know, as somebody who's written about healthcare for a long time, I felt like it'd be embarrassing not to have to be a healthcare chapter. So I actually spent a lot of time at the one free clinic in town that's on Milwaukee Street. It's right downtown. And I would just hang out there on early Wednesday afternoons, which is the weekly intake day for new and re-enrolling patients. And I just interview people in line. And I talked a lot to the people who are running that clinic. And like a lot of nonprofits in town, this clinic was holding fundraisers left and right. They were trying really hard, but the resources were outmatched by the rising need in town. So during the time that I was hanging out there, the clinic was reducing the number of people could take in every week. So I kept going back and back and back for a lot of Wednesdays until I found the perfect woman who had been a middle-class person at one of the auto suppliers who'd lost her job. So there's a chapter about what happens to her at the clinic, which is not a very happy chapter. Thank you all for coming.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.